Prepare to be astonished.
It's that time again.
Let's get started.
From the Clatsop County Historical Society, an adventure in history with Matt Burns and Alana Quila.
You should never be allowed to talk to people.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
And now, with today's adventure, it's Mac and Alana.
Welcome back to An Adventure in History. We're so happy you're joining us, and we're so happy to have a repeat guest, my Uncle Gary.
Yeah.
Also known as Gary Adams.
So we should get right into it.
Is going to talk some more about, yeah, his history in film and radio.
Because we had a great talk.
We did. We couldn't stop
talking. But there was
too much.
We couldn't stop talking. So these are things that happened, the history highlights, things that happen tomorrow, July 15th, as always. To icebreakers or at your family barbecue, thing like that.
Right into it.
1806, the Pike Expedition sets out across the American Southwest. Do you know about him?
I don't.
Zebulon Pike. And I kind of liked him as one of the explorers, the U.S. Army officer who in 1805 led an exploring party in search of the source of the Mississippi River, sets off with a new expedition to explore the American Southwest. Pike was instructed to seek out headwaters of the Arkansas, or Arkansas, I should say, and Red River. Well, see, I lived in Arkansas for a while, so there's different pronunciations.
Oh, are there really?
Yeah. Sometimes it's Arkansas, and sometimes it's Arkansas.
Ooh, is the...
And the river is the Arkansas.
It is.
Yeah, apparently, according to people in Arkansas. And Red Rivers to investigate Spanish settlements in New Mexico.
Okay.
Pike and his men left Missouri and traveled through the present-day states of Kansas and Nebraska before reaching Colorado, Pike's Peak.
Okay.
It's been up to the top of that. That's fantastic. Then they traveled down to New Mexico, where they were stopped by Spanish officials and charged with illegal entry into Spanish-held territory.
Oh.
His party was escorted to Santa Fe and then down into Mexico and then back up through Texas and finally to the border of Louisiana Territory, where they were released.
Oh.
I kind of love that.
That's interesting.
Yeah. No, you can't come into our territory.
But we're going to take you deeper in.
Yeah. Well, we're going to figure out who you are
yeah.
and
oh,
what
that's
you're
true.
Doing.
Yeah. And then we don't want you.
Whether you're spies or something else. So 1869, margarine is patented by Hippolyte Méga Maurice for use by the French Navy.
Interesting.
Yeah. I didn't realize that was the background. I knew margarine was way early, but I didn't realize it was for that. All right. 1870, the last Confederate state is readmitted to the U.S. Guess which one?
Ooh, the last one.
The last holdout.
Texas.
Georgia.
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 Okay.
What was wrong with you, Georgia?
Alabama. I mean, we could name them all. Yeah. Mississippi.
We could. 1903, the newly formed Ford Motor Company takes its first order from Chicago dentist Ernst Femming, an $850 two-cylinder Model A automobile.
Oh, my goodness.
And it was delivered just a week later. It's the very first one.
Wow.
From the Ford Motor Company.
That's pretty cool. A dentist.
Yeah, a dentist wanted a car. 1912, British National Health Insurance Act goes into effect. Okay. 1912.
Yeah.
Universal health care.
We're a tad behind.
Yeah. 1916, the Boeing Company is formed by William Boeing in Seattle.
Oh, okay.
1916, that seems really early to me.
It does.
No, obviously.
And I didn't know it was a person either.
Oh, yeah.
There you go.
1971, Nixon announces his visit to communist China.
Hmm.
1999, inaugural game at the Seattle Mariners Safeco Field.
Oh.
I'm gonna be going up there in August.
Oh, it's gonna be nice and hot.
Yeah, it is.
It's a beautiful stadium, though.
Okay, and I have a strange tie.
Mm-hmm.
1799, the Rosetta Stone is found that allows us to translate all kinds of things.
Yes.
Kind of important.
Yes.
Kind of hugely important.
Yeah.
And I'm willing to argue my tie.
Okay.
Is 2006.
Barely.
Twitter launches.
Oh.
Now, love it or hate it,
right?
It has had a huge impact on our society.
True.
And I do think it'll be a lasting impact. Even if it disappears and we all move on to something else, I think the way that we started communicating as a society, it's going to have longevity that 100 years from now, we're going to look back and, oh yeah, Twitter had a huge impact.
Well, and in 100 years, we're going to need another Rosetta Stone to decipher what people were saying on Twitter, because even I don't understand everything.
No.
I mean, LOL is about the extent. I don't have teenagers, so I don't, I'm not in the know.
But just all
on
the
tweet speak.
See all the different platforms and everything right. else. It just all is just, I mean, you might as well be speaking like the adults in the Peanuts cartoons.
I know.
Wah, 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 wah. I don't know what you're saying. So,
well, it has been a busy summer.
You've been traveling.
I've been traveling. We went to Florida. We went to Sun River. It's been just a glorious summer. I love it. I love summer on the beach.
With family and friends?
Oh, of course. Yes, always. We love traveling with our families, and we love talking with them.
And speaking of family, so we're doing a part two for the first time we've ever done this
part
before.
Part two, Uncle Gary.
Do you want to give a quick update for yes. those that may not have listened last week?
Well, I have my Uncle Gary Adams here visiting. He's from Washington, but also lived in from Omaha, Nebraska, lived in California, Florida, all over the country. And we're talking about his history and what he has provided to the radio and television industry.
And you can tell we're biased because you and I both love...
I know, both, right?
Television and radio.
Yes.
He's hitting all of our buttons here.
So as we go back, because you had just asked a question last week and I wouldn't answer, but you asked if I was interested in television when I visited your television station. And I'm trying to, I guess, remember even when I would have visited, but probably because you knew by when you were in second grade, I knew when I was in fifth grade that I wanted to go into television broadcasting.
Late in life.
Yes, a little late in life. So it could have been around that time, actually. I mean, maybe it would have been at, you know, third grade, fourth grade that we would have visited that TV station.
Yeah, and I'm not remembering, but definitely, you know, but you were the more creative side, right? So I was the technical side.
Oh, yes. You know. Yeah, we were different sides of the camera.
So when we left last week, and the reason we wanted to continue this conversation, you invented or you streamlined and made it usable.
Talk about this process.
So, and this happened in the 80s and most of the 90s, and for some time into the 2000s, it was still being used. But fundamentally, when film was shot, mostly for television, but also for major motion picture, they did a thing that was called dailies. And in the film industry, dailies are before digital, before television, they would actually shoot the film, they shoot what all the segments of the film on a given day. It would be processed overnight. And then they would make what they call prints out of that so that for the director and for all the people to look at on a daily basis. Let's call it dailies. So these would be work prints. They would scribble on them and mark them, and they would X out the cuts and takes that they didn't want, but they would be able to look at things and make sure that everything was shot the way they wanted and if they wanted to keep it and that sort of thing. So they would process the dailies that way. They would also then take these prints and start editing from them so they could actually cut these easily. They didn't hurt anything, and they could make, you know, kind of work edited viewing things so they get an idea of what the show was going to look like. In my era, when we had television stuff, we had the ability to transfer the film to videotape, and videotape was a lot easier medium, even though it's more convenient now to do it digitally, which is how they do it. But then it was videotapes, could ship those around and people could look at them. You could actually make cassettes from them and people could look at the dailies that way. So the trick was to synchronize the film, which runs at 24 frames a second, with the videotape, which runs at 30 frames a second. And then we also had to synchronize the audio, because the audio was recorded on a separate machine, which was a reel-to-reel machine. And we would synchronize that up at the same time. So now we had, in the synchronizing process, we had to deal with, you know, two different frame rates and all the electronics, and it had to be frame accurate. The only way it worked, the numbers on the film had to match the numbers on the videotape, had to match the numbers on the audio tape, so that when they would go back later, they knew exactly where these pieces of information
were. So I'm going to ask possibly a really ignorant question, but it seems like, okay, industry-wide, everybody would recognize the need for something like this, but is there a specific film company or director or somebody that is begging for this that you're dealing with that's saying, who can solve this problem for
us? I'll tell you, the director who didn't beg for it would be Steven Spielberg, because he believed in the print dailies and the mechanical editing process, which is a well-founded method of doing that. And the whole process of what they call negative cutters that would actually, you know, precisely cut the negative and edit it together, because they had to get you know, they had to be accurate. So these were very qualified people to do that. But again, for like a TV show, like just say, for instance, the shows that I know that we did were, you know, like take Cheers, for example. So that would be four cameras running with film rolling all the time in front of a live audience and different angles and stuff like that. So all these camera rolls would be processed and then they would be transferred to tape, you know, and then the tapes would have, you know, like time code burned in. Some of them would, some of, you know, just different needs and purposes, and they'd be given to people so they could make decisions on the editing, because they were highly edited shows. I mean, they, you know, they could do a lot of the stuff really well, but you still had to edit, and you had to edit from all the different angles, you know, to work with. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the things that this computer could do, is it could synchronize everything. We had to, you know, we designed custom boards that would connect to the film transfer machine, because they were unique. They weren't projectors. They were a flying spot scanner. There were several different models that did this, but the most famous one was called Rank Centel, and it was a machine that looked like a videotape machine, but it was a flying spot scanner. The film would roll. It wasn't intermittent. It was a continuous motion kind of thing. And there would be a beam of light that would scan across and a pickup device. And, you know, it's pretty interesting. But in any event, this process was used by all the major facilities, you know, Technicolor, Deluxe Video. There were hundreds of small facilities like in LA, but it ended up being sold all over the world. So it was used in any major film place, because we could work in any standard, the European standards, the US standards, and all that kind of stuff. And what was kind of fun was when you watch if you went to a movie theater and you watch the credits, everybody should watch the credits. You know? There would only be a handful of people leaving when the final credit rolls, but we were always one of them. You know,
oh. So
you don't leave before the final credits.
So if somebody goes to a movie with you, then they're forcing them to sit there for the entire thing.
That's right. That's right.
I love that.
Yeah, but anyway, it's always fun to watch the credits, because, like, I don't know anybody in the movie industry really, but I know all the what they call digital intermediate people in the industry. And it's kind of fun, because when you see somebody's name that you know, then you know that they used your equipment.
Oh.
So, because you knew what equipment that all these places had, and it was just kind of fun. So,
I find this fascinating, because this is part of the whole reason for the Oregon Film Museum, mm-hmm. is that whether it's film or television, it's not just a person in front of the camera, a director, and a guy behind the camera. There's all these people that make that magic happen. And if you're not in the industry at all, and I'm not, I'm a historian museum guy, but I love that it takes all these people, and they're all important to making this magic happen for us, the viewer.
So what comes next?
Well, so this is where history, this is probably the only reason why you really wanted me here anyway, because this part of my life relates to history. And it's one of my most proud sections. So the company I worked for that made this synchronizer, was sold the product to a company called Da Vinci. And the Da Vinci made a device, not the medical Da Vinci, but the Da Vinci made a device called color correction or color enhancement for motion picture film or video. And the idea was that and this is also something that was used everywhere in the world. We had probably 80% of the market share, maybe more. Anybody that had a motion picture film, it had to be color corrected before it could be used either on television or even in the theater, because it wouldn't necessarily be what they wanted. What the enhancement name was let's make it something different than what it really was. So you're making, you know, it look better or look worse or whatever. You had a look that you wanted to create. The color correction part would be, we shot this day and the lighting was this way, and we shot the next day and the lighting was this way, and they don't match. But we have to match them because we're pretending that we're the same day, right? So that's the color correction part of it. And a film has this unbelievable dynamic range that you can adjust colors and contrast and hue and all kind of stuff. And you have a lot of control. And our system, the system that Da Vinci made, was really, really good at that, and well known. And there were like three or four color correctors, and we were all good friends. We all knew each other that shared the space. But anyway, they bought the product for the synchronizer, and we put the synchronizer in the color corrector because the two always work together anyway. So that opened up the world, and then I started traveling more. But now here's where the history comes. Ultimately, the product that I worked on was put in the new in the color corrector, and then they redesigned the color corrector completely, and they wanted to put their own controller in. So I helped them figure that out, but I wasn't needed as much because then it was not the product that I worked on. It was a new version of it. And we had acquired a company from Singapore that came up with digital film restoration algorithms. And so this to me is where the history is and where I think it's pretty significant. We probably had about 20 or 30 different algorithms to solve different problems with film, and these would all be done digitally. And so it was a digital film restoration system sort of that we called it, and it was called Revival. And at the time, I knew nothing about it. This wasn't my area. I didn't have any specific abilities in it. But at the time, we needed a product manager for that product. They had engineers to develop it. You know, they tried to sell it, but they needed a product, somebody to take charge and understand how it worked and, you know, talk to people and train people, stuff like that. So I sort of volunteered because I could see my job changing a little bit. So I volunteered. So from about 2001 to 2009, I was a product manager for a digital film restoration system, and there were about five of us in this space worldwide that had a good set of tools. We had, you know, there were lots of little programs and software you could use to fix film problems, but ours was a fully featured system. It had automated tools, it had manual tools. It was kind of like a Photoshop for film, which is not easy because Photoshop is very complicated, but you can do things really nice in Photoshop on one frame and make it look great. Now imagine doing it on, you know, 10, 30,000 other frames so that they all line up when you play them and look good, right? So this was really significant, and we sold it all over the world, and I can name a few films that it was used on because I specifically helped with, but the company in New York that has to this day is still, they still might even be using some of the algorithms, but things have moved on. But we did movies like Carousel and King and I and stuff like that were done, you know, when they restore them, they go back to the original negative and they scan it. And then the whole thing about restoration is there's two processes. There's what they call photochemical process, and then they call it digital process. And it's very important to do as much as you can photochemically. And that means cleaning, anything you can do that doesn't hurt the film.
So are you dealing at this point with original film?
I'm not. I mean, we're a digital software, right? So the film's already been scanned. It's okay. Been cleaned and processed the best it can be. Mm. You can even do things to help remove scratches photochemically and stuff. Mm. But now it's digital. Now it's in files. Okay. So it's just files on a computer, big files, because the quality has to be high quality. So we have algorithms for scratch and dirt and dust and flicker and things like color separation where the colors don't line up and all kinds of weird, you know, damaged frames. You can have like a frame with that's totally wiped out. You can hardly recognize anything in it. So what you can do is you can look at the frames before and the frames after digitally, and you can manufacture a new frame that replaces it. And it looks pretty good. Not never perfect, but it looks pretty good.
I mean, and this is happening at the same time the TVs are improving too. Right.
Well, right. Of
and
course.
Movie theaters.
So we're starting to be high definition. We're high definition at this time. And theater, actually, we kind of did jump ahead a little bit, but theaters were becoming digital now. So these would be run digitally. They wouldn't necessarily, actually, they would make prints out of these. So some theaters would still show these films as prints, but they would also show them, other ones would show them digitally. But the best part about it is these films, When you saw these films originally in a theater, you were looking at six generations or seven generations down. You had the negative, then you had the inner negative and the inner positive and the positive, and then you had to have optical, you know, effects put in and stuff like that. So you never saw what came out of the camera. You saw multiple generations. As you know, I mean, you can be as high quality as you want, you know, things degrade over time. So when you saw a film like The King and I in the theater, it looked good, but it never looked like the camera negative. And now with the restoration process, most all films you see that have been restored digitally, you're looking at the original negative, and it's the only thing that was altered were things that were fixed. And you just won't believe what the original negative looks like. The best examples are, if you watch The Wizard of Oz, if you can see it on a, you know, in a good presentation, or watch North by Northwest is one of my favorites. Good friends of mine restored it. I don't think any of my equipment was used to do that, but they were still really good quality people that know what they're doing. It's hard to believe how good that stuff looks, you know, because you're seeing that. I mean, yeah, they didn't see the original camera negative when they made it, you know?
So again, I'm going into tech areas that I'm not knowledgeable enough on, but there's very a huge difference between photographs from the 1890s are far sharper than anything in the 1990s. Is the same for film, or have we improved the camera so much in the 1920s or 30s versus the 1950s and 60s.
Some of the things about print films and static shots and things like that is that the cameras from a long time ago had large format, I would say film, but like a glass plate, you know, that's a 6x10 inch glass plate. That came out of the camera. That is the negative, you know, from the thing, but it's got a lot of resolution because it's big. Now the lens quality might not have been as good as lenses are today, but when you consider the size of the sensor that's in your camera now, compared to a glass plate, you're gonna, you know, sensors of course are really good and they do have a lot of high resolution stuff. But I mean, if you try to compare the size of these prints that you get from 100 years ago, they look really good because, you know, they just had a big surface to work with in the beginning. When you take 35 millimeter film and go shoot with that with a camera and you try to compare that to an 8x10, you know, image, it's not the same. But the digital thing now is so much better. It's still, you know, we still suffer with the size of the sensor and the type of sensor that it is. And then, of course, lenses mean everything. The glass is important.
But film restoration, I think it's important, too, to point out this is not CGI. This is not adding anything. Like you said,
That's correct. Going
back to the original. And if anything is altered, it's something that was after the fact anyways.
That's
like a scratch.
And it is very difficult when they do restore a film. They have two purposes to think about. One, they want to preserve the original film. So an archive always wants to preserve the original. They're not as much interested in a restored product as they are. They want to make sure that original still is there, because maybe down the road we'll want to take The Wizard of Oz and do it again, you know, and make it even better. It's hard to say that it would be worth doing that, but again, you know, we sit here now and 20, 30 years from now it might be different. But the other side is a product. So like, take for instance, the person who had the best method of preserving, you know, their films would have been Walt Disney, because they knew, he figured out, or his coworkers figured out, that we're going to preserve our color films by making black and white separations of them, because black and white isn't going to fade over time. Color fades over time. So of course, in those days, a lot of the color films were made from three black and white. So the original Technicolor film was either two separate films or three separate films, and they were really black and white films, but they had color filters from the light to determine what was on there, if you follow how that works.
Yeah.
So anyway, they would make a print like The Wizard of Oz, and they say, okay, this is great. We're going to look at it. We're projecting it in the theaters, but we want to save this print now is how we want it edited, how we want it to look and everything. We want to save it now. So we're going to make what we call a YCM, or a yellow, cyan, and magenta preservation of that. And that will be three separate black and white film strips made from the color. And those won't fade in color. They stay the same. You know, they'll have their issues over time, but you'll be able to preserve the original color when you put them back together again for hundreds and thousands of years. So Disney did that with all of his stuff. That's why when you look at anything that they had, that they did a long time ago, they can put it, the color is amazing. Or if you look at a Technicolor film, Technicolor wasn't real color. It was just a beautiful process of printing process that they had, but they had to make the three separate films in the camera, the camera that shot on three separate negatives. And then they combined them to make the prints. And then the prints would be printed with this ink method that I can't describe because it's photochemical, but it was gorgeous. And they can make those same colors today because, again, the films are black and white that they're preserved on. So,
wow. I told you I had a lot to say.
I'm totally geeking out here.
I know. So to wrap up, this is a question for both of you. Why is it important to preserve these mediums?
Well, I'm going to jump in because he's going to give a better answer. So I'm going to give the worst answer first. I like something that you said was that we want to, an archive wants to save these things. But the difference to me between an archive and a museum is the museum wants to save it, but we also want to use it. We want to use it for education. We want to show it. We want to do something with it. So we have that dual purpose that we do want to keep the archival original version, but we also want to make it useful and usable.
No, that's exactly right. And I was going to talk about the other step there. Like when Disney starts releasing some of their restored materials, they will change them in some cases. Some people say, well, some of the animated stuff will, you know, they might enhance them and stuff like that. But again, it's a product, you know, they're not wrecking the original at all, but they still have a product that they want to sell and they want to make it, you know, viewable. So the most viewers want to look at it. We won't talk about colorizing films, but there's a reason for it. You know, I don't watch them myself, but there's a reason why they did it because it's a product. It's a sellable thing and there are people that'll watch it. So yes, an archive wants to preserve the original. A museum will want to, you know, like you might have a piece of art that's made out of a film thing. You'll want to run it a million times so you make a copy so that it's a viewing thing so people can look at. And if you need to make another one, you can make another one from the original and look at it again. And then if you want to make a product out of it, you can do that too. So there's a lot of different steps there.
I love it. Well, this episode's dedicated to the love of radio and television.
So I have to ask one final question. Mm-hmm. Is what is the number one best thing from your career that you can remember? Because you've described a lot of different things that could be the highlight. So what is your favorite thing? Like if you're like, hey, this is the best thing I ever did. What is that? Is it like asking your favorite child?
Favorite niece right here.
I would, you know, the thing is, I would say probably the most proudest thing that I was involved with was the restoration side. And I'm still involved in an organization that, of archivists. I'm not an archivist, but I'm still involved in the organization. I volunteer for them to this day, even though I don't do anything specifically in that area. The company I work for now actually makes a film scanner. We make a lot of things that I'm still in broadcast, and I love that part of it, and that's where I'll stay for the rest of my life now. But probably the film restoration. But I'm also proud, again, it relates to film, the synchronizer, because I wrote a good fair amount of the software to do that, and was quite proud of that.
I remember, I think you said 80% of the world are used in eight, right? And it was 3 to 4 people in the room that did it. Is that correct? Yeah. Good job. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for indulging us. And this was fantastic. So I'm glad you brought your uncle in.
Yes. Gary Adams. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
All right. Go make some history. We'll catch you next time. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for joining us for An Adventure in History. An Adventure in History is created and produced by the Clatsop County Historical Society and brought to you by KMUN.